This is Paul Siegel. You're listening to Wandering DMs. Wandering DMs is broadcast live at 1 p.m. Eastern on twitch.tv/wanderingdms and youtube.com/wanderingdms/live. And now, on with the show.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to Wandering DMs. I'm Paul.
And I'm Dan, and today on Wandering DMs, we'll be asking the question, should you keep your D&D adventure map hidden or reveal it to the players at the start of the game? And here's a twist. There are some surprising benefits of giving your players more information instead of less. All that and more today on Wandering DMs.
Before we begin today's conversation, I will remind our viewers that at the end of the show, we will be hosting our After Party chat. That is a live video chat that Dan and I host on our Discord server with all our patrons. And you can join in by becoming a patron. Just visit patreon.com/wanderingdms, pledge at any tier, and you'll get an invite to our private Discord server. Get that all set up over the course of the show, and maybe about 10 or 15 minutes after the end of the show, around 2:10 to 15 Eastern time, we will be there and looking forward to talking to all of you.
We have such great patrons, Paul. And for example, our patron Bacrius is checking in right now that we're currently live on YouTube and Twitch and Restream. So thank you for that. Thanks everybody who can join us here live on this Sunday. You know, Paul, I was noticing in our intro video that there was a little clip there of you and me co-DMing a session of a D&D game at a convention. And got the big battle map out, and I think the whole area was pretty much drawn pretty early on as the players were exploring that. So this issue came up last week, I think, in the after chat with our patrons, where we always get such great ideas of how, and it's something that I personally have unintentionally stumbled into over and over again about how many benefits there are to maybe partially revealing the map to your players up front. Is that something that you've accidentally wandered into, or is that something that like you've always known of, like, I gotta get more information to my players?
I don't know that I knew it for that purpose. I feel like that I've stumbled into it time and time again and always been pleased with the outcome, if that makes any sense at all.
Me too.
So, and there's a couple of ways it comes up, right? And there's some discussion here. All right, let me just put this one, right? So,
is this William's comment?
Show the map, wilderness probably, dungeon probably not. Interesting because I'm not sure. I would say there are cases where showing the dungeon map is also interesting.
I think it's a pretty strong argument. I think that I'm pretty close to what William's saying there myself, thinking about it this weekend. One thing I'll say is, right out of the box, as we all know, original D&D 74 Wilderness Adventures were, and we're looking at right now because we do use as the background to our show, the map from the prior outdoor survival game from Avalon Hill by Jim Dunnigan. And that was how you were canonically supposed to play Wilderness Adventures in D&D. You throw out the outdoor and the survival map, everyone can see everything. And then the question is, how do you get from one side to the other? Do you go through the mountains? Do you go through the desert? Do you wander through the forests? And what different kinds of monsters show up in those different locations? That was D&D Wilderness Adventuring with the map in front of you. So that's a pretty strong argument that's where it comes from initially. I can pull up some other examples if you're not convinced.
But let me talk a little bit about the historical basis of the dungeon map, right? So the interesting thing about the dungeon map, right, is if you go back to the wargaming roots, right, from what we've heard is that this comes from war games where they were trying to like sap walls and castles, right? And so the process then was you'd get out your piece of graph paper and you'd be mapping where your sappers are digging tunnels to try and undermine the walls of your enemy's castle, right? And then maybe you had counter sappers coming from the other side and they're drawing on a piece of graph paper, and then maybe you show the graph, you know, somebody, a referee possibly compares them to find out when they collide, right?
Right.
So in that basis, right, from that basis, then you've got this idea of the map is secret, right? It's a secret, like I don't want my enemy to see where I'm digging tunnels, and my enemy doesn't want to see where he's digging tunnels, and you know, and then you've got some comparison. But let me throw this historical nugget out at you, Dan. I'm sure we're going to get into lots of examples of when the map was given to the players or not, but I don't think this one was on your list, and it is on mine, which is the very first ever published D&D module, Palace of the Vampire Queen, absolutely had player maps that were supposed to be handed out to the players.
Interesting.
Here's what I'm showing here on screen now is a side-by-side of the first level. On the left is the player map, and on the right is the DM map. Maybe that doesn't come out so great.
I'm
just going to grab my copy.
I mean, it seems totally detailed to me. I mean, I get. Okay, I'm just realizing now. There's a couple. Right. Okay. There's a couple secret areas that aren't shown. Like at first glance, it has the entire layout without any keys for that player map on the left.
Here's level five. Yeah. Right. So I think you're intended, based on the way this is printed, to unbend the staples here and pull out, because they have nothing on the backs, right? You're supposed to pull these out and literally hand the player maps to the players. And yes, there are the player map is incomplete, right? The secret areas are missing from the player map, as is the key, right? You can see those are the major differences if you look at side by side, right? The player map doesn't have the key, and the player map is missing certain secret areas.
Yeah. Interesting. Very interesting. You know, Paul, I had this sense memory, and I'm not, you know, Vampire Queen is not something I'm super familiar with. I had this sense memory, again, kind of going back to William's comment, that I've seen this before, that I've seen dungeon layouts like that. And I tried to peruse my library of TSR, you know, D&D modules, and I came up empty on, you know, kind of like that, the outline of dungeon areas now, but there was a lot of wilderness examples like that that I could find, but I actually failed to find any TSR branded dungeon player maps. And you're just now making me remember that the sense memory I was getting was from Tegel Manor. Tegel Manor does the same thing, an enormously elaborate palace that's, you know, ruined with hundreds of dungeon areas, that comes with a big poster sized layout of just the outline of the manor. And then as players explore through it, they can fill in that outline with where they adventure. So that's coming back to mind now.
That's where that comes from. That is fascinating to me. Okay. Cause I had another example, which is not in the printed material, but is how I learned how to run the scenario, which is, I'm going to have more visual aids here, but it is House on Hangman's Hill. Now this is a Judge's Guild adventure.
Yep.
And it doesn't say anything about giving, like, there's nothing in the content that says give the players a map, or there's no handout for give the players a map. But what's included is really actually difficult to parse map, unfortunately, like many of some of the early maps. Like, you get this feeling like the grid was superimposed later and nothing quite lines up properly. When I ran this, I went through and I redrew the map by hand myself, right? So here's my redrawing of the map to nicely align on grid. Now, the interesting thing that I did from this is what is in this dungeon, and I learned this adventure by playing it at a convention, and I just totally aped what I saw the DM who was running it for me do, which is there's fiction in there about how the entire mansion disappears, right? It is only there for one night, right? It appears in the middle of the night. You can go explore it, hopefully get some treasure, but better get out by dawn, because the whole mansion's going to vanish, and it won't come back for a year, right? That's straight out of the fiction of the module. So what my DM did, and what I then aped, was the first thing that we handed to the players is an outline of the map.
Exactly that.
Because if you go up there during the day, the foundation is still there, right? So you can poke around and be like, okay, well, this is where the mansion's going to show up, and you can get the outline of it. And you can see, like, paths, right? You know, there's a well, stuff like that. You can kind of see, like, okay, this is the shape of the space. And so I always, when I'm running this module, I 100% give this page that we're looking at now, which is just a blank outline, but it's on a grid, right? And I go, here you go. Wow. You can fill this in if you want. Here's your map.
You know, I will say that, so just as an initial stab, it's a, if you weren't going to do anything else about revealing maps to players, it's an interesting option to just give them, give flat out give the players an outline of like where the entrance is on the piece of graph paper. And I've done that in the past, and I couldn't find any examples, but I know I've done that in the past for the whole giant sequence. So steading of the Hill Giant Chief is a big outdoor, enormous stockade, basically. You can totally, it makes sense. You can scout around the outside area and figure out what the geography is. And just like that, I just hand the players a pre-made map of the outline. It doesn't come normally with the adventure. I did that for the Glacial Rift adventure. And then I also did that for the Hall of the Fire Giant King. And then that becomes a little bit ironic because that is actually underground and all you get is just one single door on the very corner of the map. So it's just like two squares, double doors. That's it. That's all you get, which was kind of a funny follow-up to the more information that had come in the prior adventures. But that at least prevents the frustration of players putting the entryway in the wrong place and then having to get two pieces of paper and go like five squares. You've done this. You have to go five squares into another piece of paper and you've used up a whole piece of paper just for that. And you keep snaking back and forth between it. And I will say like Friday night, I accidentally stumbled into that again. I was playing my Star Frontiers game. Our good friend Max was mapping. And I should have been more explicit about the scale and where to start, because sure enough, he's having to go to multiple pieces of paper Friday night. And I'm remembering, right, I didn't totally prep that out, but you can at least prevent that. I will say with that Hangman's Hill adventure, even better, because it's in world that when you get there, there's only the outline. And then later on, the rest of it shows up. So that's even higher tier.
I like that a lot. It's nice that it's representative of the fiction. I enjoy that a lot. That's why I totally stole it. There's nothing in the book that tells you should do this, but the DM who ran it for me did it. And I was like, that's brilliant. I am stealing that 100%. I think we can both agree just like as a order, as a process of running D&D, if you do have a player who is doing the mapping, I think it is valuable just to tell them where to start on their piece of paper. Right. Start on the left side. Yeah. Start in the middle. Start at the bottom. Right. Yeah. Just because, even if you're going full on like, no, I want, you know, they should have no information whatsoever. This is a complete surprise to them. Like, there's nothing fun about that process of going, I'm close to the edge of the page. I got to go. Yeah. I got to go make a marker and start again over here. And then my map is all, you know, chopped into pieces and annoying. Agreed. Like, there's just nothing fun about that process. So might as well cut it.
I agree. And when I was playing Curse of the Azure, Pool of Radiance. When I was playing Pool of Radiance for about a year here on the channel in a series, I totally did that. I wasn't super happy. I know that I'm only a couple. And then at some point, I actually deduced that all the areas, every single region was 16 by 16. And I could start pre-planning how to use my graph paper. Nothing else, that makes a great point of just like give them the outline and tell them where to start. That makes a lot of sense.
Now I have seen, right, and we can get into the wilderness aspect and we should talk about that for sure because everybody seems to agree that like give them the wilderness map, but I want to pick more at the dungeon map because the trope I've seen a lot of is like giving them an incomplete map, right? And maybe this probably originates frankly from the whole like treasure map item in the treasure tables.
Yes.
Right. So the thing that I remember this most from, and I wish I had it in front of me. I went digging through boxes of old material here to see if I still owned this thing or not, which unfortunately I don't, because it's a second edition AD&D book. It was just called Treasure Maps. Here it is by Slade Henson. I don't know if you've ever seen this one, Dan.
I have never heard of this.
No. Oh, it's a great and like I was trying to hunt for any source of it and I couldn't find it. So I remember owning this as a kid when I was first into D&D. And the interesting thing was it was just a little booklet of like one-off dungeons, like very short, like couple of page dungeons. That's it. Just a huge quantity of them. But it was all with the supposition. It was a lot of maps. There's a lot of imagery and a lot of maps in here. And the point was, hey, when you roll on the treasure table and you get a treasure map and you don't have anything to give your players, here's a thing you could give them. And so basically, almost all the content in this, I don't know what to call it, accessory. There probably was in their accessory line, right? It's not quite a module. It's not quite a
It's an official game accessory, I can see.
There you go. Like a lot of the entries had that of like, here's two copies of a map. One of them's been like maybe a little burnt up. Or I remember there was one that was like the map was actually painted on the outside of a ceramic urn and you give it to the player in shards, like all cut up and broken up. You know, you shards of pottery and if you piece it together, right? But a lot of stuff like that where, you know, many times, not all of them, but many of the entries in here, they always had a handout. I know that they always had a hand. There was always a, here's the thing you give to your players when they say, you find a treasure map, here it is. Sometimes it was like, here's a wilderness map to get to a dungeon, and then the one for the DM is the dungeon. But there was many of them were like, well, here's an incomplete map of the area that they're going to explore, or, you know, one that's been damaged or is erroneous or whatnot.
Nice. Cool.
Yeah.
You know, okay, let me just tangent. If I can tangent just a tiny little bit. I don't think we've said it on the show. I've been watching the TV show Krapopolis by Dan Harmon. And if you haven't seen, of course, we know that Dan Harmon is a huge D&D fan. And some of us have watched Harmon Quest in the past. And we've had their DM on here on our show before, fortunately, Spencer Crittenden. And Krapopolis is basically a D&D show, right? Okay. So you can watch Krapopolis, and it's basically a D&D show trying to run a city in ancient times. So I enjoy it thoroughly. I think it's really smart. And one of the clever things they do is they use painted urns as basically like their newspapers. So the show usually starts with them sitting at the breakfast table, passing around an urn, looking at the paintings and go, oh, did you see what happened in Thebes recently? Oh yes. Very interesting. we should check that out or something like that. So using the painted urns give information is really quite entertaining, I will say. So that's a great idea. Yeah. I do feel, you know, that it's funny because the random treasure tables in original D&D, specifically, if you know, you've got your coinage, and then you've got this category for maps or magic. And when you get into that category, the first thing you have to roll for is it a magic item or is it a map? And I think usually it's around like 30 to 70%. It's like 30% you get some kind of map, 70% you get some kind of magic. And I've said it before, but when I was younger, I scrupulously avoided all of the map results. And younger self was intrigued with like, oh, magic sword, or, you know, the horn of blasting, or, you know, a cloak of elvenkind. Oh, what kind of interesting magic item to boost up my players am I going to see? That seemed exciting. And the maps seemed relatively very dry. And so I would, you know, cheat the dice, frankly, all the time, or just ignore it. And I'm realizing that that is a really key part of the play, as I think many of us agree with, of giving more information about where to go next, or a goal or something that you can pursue in the dungeon. And I wish that, you know, the early books had very little design explanations. Had very little, like, what? Mm. Why is this element here? What are we going to do with it? They were sketchy. They were hobbyist, and they didn't have any rationale for why you would want a dungeon map. And so, I personally overlooked that for years. But that is, you know, arguably, maybe that's a really key part. You know, there's in the original D&D books, all through the first decade, there's no advice about how much information or how many clues to give out for players going into a dungeon to be able to make decisions about where to go next. And it's very easy to make a random map, and you walk in and there's some branches and you can go northeast or west. why would the players go one way rather than another? There isn't any information in those early dungeons. Maybe the adventures have rumors, maybe. And then, you know, maybe you can get one of these random maps. And maybe that's the key thing. I mean, maybe they should have pointed that out. These are the ways that you're going to get information to players that they can make intelligent decisions going forward. That's enormously important for your play. And I feel really dumb for having overlooked how really critically important those randomly appearing maps are. That might be really integral to how the dungeon game is supposed to be played, frankly.
Interesting. Yeah, I definitely remember, you know, not knowing what to do with that entry in the chart as a kid. And that was, frankly, the attraction of that accessory to me, right? Was like, oh, an answer, thing, right?
Yes.
So, yeah. That's fascinating.
Yeah. There's no, I mean, the random map tables don't give any hints about whether the goal should be in the current dungeon or not. And frequently they're aiming you to like outdoor locations, right? That becomes a design problem for the DM. I want a turnkey solution. I don't want to have to be directed to make an entire other wilderness adventure and lair location when I'm already having trouble juggling the design for my one dungeon. So if there'd been a little note there about, you know, pick a place in the dungeon where you want to direct your players or something like that, that would have been very helpful. But, you know, me being a little bit OCD, if it says there's a 1,000-league wilderness adventure that you have to design, I would commit to starting to do that. But if you're designing a space, you should use it to give information about the space, I think, is my takeaway. Let's look at the wilderness. I do want to look at the wilderness because, I think it's a short story, is that very similar to the outline idea, maybe with Hangman's Hill. There's a lot of early TSR adventures. I think Julian was the first one in the chat to say, for example, the Isle of Dread adventure has an outline of the island for the players. So I think I have, there's a black and white, you know, island map that I have there. Yep. So that is from Module X1, just like Julian said, that's by our heroes, Dave Cook and Tom Moldfay, who made the BX rules. And so when you get to that very famous Isle of Dread adventure, that's exactly what happens. And I think it makes sense because you have this very natural, craggy outline. That would be a nightmare to try to describe verbally and have players document. I guess there are some old school DMs for whom that would be the game itself, is that amusing, frustrating struggle. But so much better, give them the complicated outline. It makes sense in game that you could take your ship and just sail around the exterior and see what the outline is basically like. And then, again, that gives you some strategic choices about, do you want to try to get on via the very threatening mountains, like in the northwest? Mm-hmm. Do you want to try to get in through the jungle in the southwest? Do you want to, you can see the villages and the path on the southeast. And so you have some information about making decisions about where to go, which I think is a great option. They do this a lot. I think the early TSR adventures, more often than not, if you're in a wilderness space, they give you the same kind of outline. Gygax,
you know, it's basically the same effect as what I was just talking about with Hangman's Hill, right? You get the outline of this play space, but the interior is all mysterious.
Yeah. Exactly. And then you can start, you know, doing your hex crawl exploration, you know, from some known location. Again, not get super frustrated. So now all the players have to do is just fill in a particular hex, right, with a shape, with some kind of territory. So that's a fundamentally feasible mapping challenge, which makes sense. It's not overly huge. Now, Gygax's Isle of the Ape, that was kind of, frankly, sort of the same inspiration, basically inspired by King Kong, more or less, both of these, a much larger map. I couldn't fit it here in the show because it's a two-panel giant thing. and gives you the outline. One corner has the native villagers that you can start at, and has a much larger area. We may or may not need to see it, but Quagmire, I know, I think you're a pretty big fan of, Paul, does the exact same thing of give you the outline. There it is. Thank you.
I ran Quagmire back in the day, mm-hmm. and I will say the at that point I wasn't in the practice of doing like big wilderness hex crawls, which I'm not to do.
Yeah.
So what this in my play, what this boiled down to was just the spirit of what they've had was a map to the location. Right. And then,
yeah,
because it is, if I recall, I mean, you can't really see it here, but I'm pretty sure that there's a little label there that says like, here's the dungeon.
Totally. Kind of lower middle. It says, here's Quagmire with an arrow. It says right here. Then you're supposed to give that to the players.
Yep. Yeah. So I don't. Are they expecting that you're going to basically hex crawl your way from one of those towns in the north all the way down through the peninsula to get there? Or you're going to get a boat?
Well,
in which case, who cares about the interior of any of this?
Yeah, even worse. I mean, so the known world, the D&D known world starting territory is off to the east. So traditionally you get a boat there, you'd sail in from the eastern edge and then have to, you know, with some random encounters and weather would be basically it. Can you get all the way from the coast down to the Quagmire? And then you may recall that the one highlighted place is not the end of the adventure. There's at least two or three additional ruins, I guess I'm going to say, that then you get directed to, and then you have to do a little bit of a harder hunt to find those two or three other ruins and get the additional stuff that you need. It turns into a bit of a hex crawl anyway.
This is gonna lead us right back to the original topic here. I remember running that, and like I liked that basic premise that there was like multiple locations that were identical, and you had to go find them and whatnot. And I'd say the actual like actually running Quagmire didn't go so great for me, though. Frankly, part of that was just a player problem that they decided they fell to internal strife in the boat ride over. So we never really got to the content because they just decided to kill each other first. But. That said, I love that concept, and much later I developed my own adventure to run at a convention that was basically there are three locations. There are these three artifacts that were hidden in these three locations that are old fortifications of this ancient civilization that's long gone. You need to go find them for us. And I basically just quickly, I think I just teleported the party into each location. Like, okay, you've got a wizard who's like willing to just shoot you straight to the location. But what was not known to them was that all three locations were identical. I think you played in this, right? It's just so interesting, right? Because while I didn't hand you the map.
I've run Quagmire. I have, right. I've played in your castle game that's parallel to it. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. So I didn't give the players the map, but all three locations used the same map, right? The layout of the location was the same. Yeah. And it was interesting because in one case, it was occupied. I think like it had been taken over by hobgoblins. In another case, it was in a lofty crag remote somewhere. So it was kind of wild and deteriorating. And in a third case, it had half sunken into a swamp. And so part of it was underwater. But the layout was always the same. And I think the players, if you could remind me maybe, but I think it couldn't have been far into the second one where suddenly the aha moment went of, oh, it's the same exact layout.
I think that I actually have a little bit of scar tissue from that adventure because I thought I wasn't supposed. I thought that would be metagaming, and I actually avoided saying that for quite a while. And I feel really dumb for not using the clues that were available because I saw that and then avoided saying it at the table as a player for a while. And that was really dumb of me. I will try not to do that again.
Pass it up to lazy adventure writing. Oh, he's just reusing the same map. He couldn't be bothered to write three unique maps.
I wouldn't say that.
That's what's fun about it. Yeah. But that is that was supposed to be an example, right, of like, give the players a little more information, right? Like, I think that is fun, right? That that there was, for example, in there's a secret door into a little secret hidden place in all three locations. And depending on what order you go to them, one of them, like, it's just, it's been broken open. So, you know, once you see it in one spot, you can go, oh, this must exist in the other ones too.
That was very clever. It was much more clever design than I was dealing with, than I thought I was dealing with at the time. That's a really well laid out adventure. You know, let me, I have to address one great question from Vino Azul in the chat here, who asked, we are ignoring the obvious question, how big are the hexes? This is a good point. In the two examples we just saw of wilderness stuff, Isle of Dread has 1 mile hexes. And I think that's reasonable. That's a reasonable space that you could say, we're going to explore this as ventures and map it out. The Quagmire map, among my criticisms, is that, and that's not super great design, it's way too big. Like, that map we were looking at for Quagmire, I think, is about the same size as Europe, right? Which has a grand total of two villages on the map. And it's somewhere between the sides of either like Florida, southeastern U.S. and all of Europe there in this one map. And so the idea that you've just have this enormous, ridiculously enormous space, and the hexes here are 24 miles, 8 leagues across, like a whole day of walking. And they tended to do that with the later X module. So X6, X7, X8, X9, kind of all, like, actually everything from X4 tend to have these enormous, enormous spaces with 24 mile hexes. Not super reasonable at all that you have so little population, frankly, in it. Kind of doesn't make sense. I will say that the benefit of having this map when I ran Quagmire back in the day with my players is that they looked at this and said, well, there's so few communities here. It's going to be extremely, extremely easy for us to raise an army and invade and just take over those two towns. Just take over the two towns there. And then you have a stranglehold on the entire trade route from the entire known world to this other set of kingdoms on the west. And every single piece of trade has to go through us. And that's exactly what they did. And so we burst out the war game. Very quickly, they knocked over the two towns, and they owned those two towns, and that was actually where the rest of my D&D campaign existed from then on. That's what I got out of the player's map. Was we can just knock this whole thing over and take it.
All right, I want to take us in another direction, Dan. So, like, when we're looking at those wilderness,
okay, well, before maps, we do, I have one more example before we do that, and I apologize so much, but I would like to pick up the player's map from Descent into the Depths of the Earth. And so it's a hex map that just has kind of a diagonal path. So and this is my last example here, because it's not technically outdoors wilderness, but it is in the Underdark as you actually get this right at the end of the Fire Giant adventure by Gygax. And then this actually maps out where you're going to go for the three modules worth of Descent into the Depths, Shrine of the Coatoa, Vault of the Drow are all here. And so, again, it's 1 mile hexes, if I recall. The whole, you know, written publication sequence is on this path. It's everywhere you're going to go. There's a lot of blank territory off to the sides that you can go exploring if you're really, really adventurous. And the other thing that's on here is there's little iconic symbols on each of the spaces that the players can use as a little bit of a clue, as you might be able to guess kind of what's at each of the places based on those little iconic tokens. So like the first one on the bottom right has an eye. The second one has, maybe that's kind of an octopus. I don't know what's in the Underdark that kind of looks like an octopus. You might be able to guess. So again, I think that shows that it's interesting if something is enormously elaborate, right? And the Underdark here has just an enormous number of intricate, hard to map areas. Whether it's the wilderness or whether it's the Underdark, if it's big and it's super complicated, there is a bit of an instinct here to give the players a roadmap about where you're going to go to have some idea before you get too overwhelmingly lost. And I think that's an interesting example of that.
Huh. Now I remember you running this for us, Dan. Did you give us this map? Was this a handout? Okay. I kind of vaguely remember that happening. And honestly, I have to say that I think my instinct was to look at this map and go, what is this? This is not helpful, and disregard it.
Well, I see that. You know, I get that because it's an unusual layout and it's not entirely customary tokens, right? So it's, I mean, I think we would immediately recognize doors, stairs, you know, a pool in a standard dungeon. But since this is a line map and the areas are particular hexes, I can totally understand, Paul, you know, this isn't a customary mapping protocol. And I remember, you know, me go, oh, I'm showing all the information, and you and other players going, I don't know what I'm looking at here, and me being kind of crestfallen as a result. This is actually a good point. Maybe there should be a key on there, possibly.
And you know, actually, you know what I think would actually sell it better, and this is so silly, but remove the hex grid. Remove the hex grid from this.
Okay.
And I think it immediately becomes more interesting.
I get it. I think the counter argument would be it's set up for you to do more exploring, like with Isle of Dread or Quagmire, is that you can go off the map, and then you can go off the prepared places, and then the hex map would give you some structure to mapping out the many, many, many unseen tunnels that you could go exploring into. So I think that maybe is the intent. But I hear what you're saying.
Hmm.
I'm thinking maybe a key. So
I think this might draw me into the comment I was trying to make earlier, which is simply this. So I want to start with, like, I actually don't think there is a huge difference between whether it's an outdoor exploration or a dungeon. I don't see a massive difference about whether you should give the map or not give the map based on either of those. And I think what it really comes down to is just the play style of what you're looking for. And, you know, how much information are you giving the players, and, like, you know, what are the interesting decision points, I think is really fascinating. So, like, for example, the big open map, like we saw in House of Hangman's Hill or Quagmire, I feel like those are almost less interesting. They're interesting. It's cool, right? Okay, great. I've got a space to fill in. But unless you're expecting them to explore all of it, it seems just the white space, I think, is a little overwhelming. Let me give you a counter example here. Here's a map that is included in an adventure written by Dyson Logos if I'm going to remember the name of this, it's something like Journey to the Red Caves or something like that. I'm going to have to look it up. It might be a treasure map to the Red Caves, because this is a case of him saying, like, oh, my players found a treasure map and I needed to give them something. So here it is. So here's the map. And I've run this one.
Okay.
And I adore this map. It is pretty full, right? So it seems like you're giving the players a lot of information, but not really, right? Like, you just got to sort of look at the map. There's no units. There's confusing. Like, there's a dotted line, which we assume is a path. It looks like I could make out a house, and I guess that's the cave I'm trying to reach in the bottom right. And then a lake and a swamp and a skull, right? So there does become interesting decision points here of, like, do we approach the house? Is the house friendly or not? Do we go over the hills through the swamp? What's the big skull? Is it a literal big skull, or am I being told that this is a dangerous space? I don't know.
Great. 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 Yeah. Yeah. I like that.
So I adore this map, right? And I've played this a couple of times and given my players, like, here's the map. And I think there is really fun play to be made there where, like, there's still a ton of secrets, right? There's still a ton of secrets, but you've given them something, some incomplete piece of information to go on. And I think that's where it becomes fun.
I will admit that my instinct is not to go for a map like that. And I almost can't even explain why. I feel like, I guess I'm personally intrigued by the detail of a gridded map or a hex map that we normally get provided as referees. And I feel like part of me kind of wants to share that, I don't know, intricacy that, like, oh, there's been a lot of work that's been put into this. I kind of want to show that to the players. And I guess I've historically always shied away from, as solid as an argument as you're making for it, Paul, I tend to shy away from this for, I don't know, it seems, I don't know why. Like, would a person actually make a map that looks like this? I don't know, but obviously, I got
honestly, this strikes me. This strikes me as way like if, especially if you're talking about like a handout for a treasure map. This strikes me as way more treasure mappy than anything else. Like, I like that there's no unit measure. Yeah. I like that it's inaccurate. Yeah. How long is it going to take me to go around the swamp? Is that a day of travel, many days of travel, weeks of travel? I don't know, right? And I did this a lot, honestly, when I was running a Warhammer Fantasy campaign, is I would give my players maps like this that were vaguely accurate. And I would just tell them, like, yeah, map making in this period's not great. Like, and this is, like, historically accurate to the time periods we're trying to roleplay, or they're not really, not that we're being historically accurate in role-playing fantasy adventure.
But I hear what you're saying. I mean, no, I want to honor that.
That kind of, you know, if you look at maps from, like, the medieval period or whatnot, they're not super accurate, right? And it's, I've enjoyed that, as I enjoyed giving my players a map and being like, yeah, this is the best they were able to come up with. Here you go. Right. And then again, you're giving them kind of this partial information.
I struggle with this issue because my understanding of actual medieval times is that you had these like global maps that were very, I don't know, thematic, I guess, but like Europe's here and Asia's there and Africa's here. And they didn't even have any capacity to imagine it being partly accurate for navigation. And for, you know, regional navigation, they're just, you know, maps weren't used. And instead you had, and I always forget the name of these books that they had, these text, go here, turn left, take the path, go here, go left, go right for both ships and walking. We're actually given travel guides in text that those of us of a particular generation would possibly recognize, kind of like triptychs or something. And you know, I go back and forth about should I? It's weird because, you know, the D&D game is originally verbal. Really, should I do that? Should I give navigation by text like that? Would people then just visualize what the connections are? And I should give them a sketchy map like we're looking at right now, that kind of better communicates to the players what the text directions are telling you to do for the roadways. And I actually kind of go back and forth about that a little bit. But it's completely defensible. We're visual creatures. Giving it to our players in visual form is informative and entertaining. So it's a really solid choice, I think.
I'm kind of delighted by this idea of giving the players a map in text form. Of saying like, here's your treasure map. It's actually just a verbatim description of someone just, you know, dictating to someone else. Yeah, I went here and then I turned right and then right. And especially again, in my heart of hearts, I always want these kinds of adventures. I want these recordings, these pieces of information I give to the players to be slightly wrong. I don't want them to be 100% accurate, right? Yep. I think that's the big thing is I don't want to give them something where I'm like, here is the literal dungeon. You can see all of the information. It's all here. Execute, right?
Yeah.
Feel like that's
what I think Julian found the name I was looking for. Portland charts, I think, is what Julian came up with. But I agree. I like the slightly off, slightly, you know, and we've said it before, you know, one of the best things you can do is if you have multiple players, multiple play groups go through an area and someone has a partial map and you hand that to player group two and player group one messed it up probably, but you know, more than I could have if I'd made it up. It's partly messed up and it's sketched out and it's crossed out and it's erased and they go, oh God, what psycho did this? That's a really great way that you can recycle artifacts in your game. We've had great joy with that. And of course, Paul, you've done that with when it's the same player group but different characters.
Yeah. I've collected a player's map and then rehanded it back out and said, like, here you go.
Yeah.
You want a map to this area? This is what was recovered. Yeah, that's delightful. I kind of want to now. I'm like really curious now about writing an adventure where it begins with here is a handout of an oral description of someone who's been to this location before. And in fact, I bet you could twist this too of being like, it's written in Dwarven. Who at the table understands Dwarven? Only you are allowed to read this, right? That would be hilarious, I think. Let me give... I got a couple more examples to run into, and you probably do too. I feel like I'm stealing the show here. But Another funny example of a case where you have a wilderness map and we have a version that's for the DM and for the player. And you may recognize this one, Dan, because this one was written by Dan Collins and Paul Siegel. It's called WDM04.
Now, to be fair, of course, the map itself, the original map is by Dyson Logos. So we took one of Dyson's free open maps, and that's the one on the bottom, right? If I recall correctly,
Both of these maps have been edited. Neither one of these is the Dyson Logos map.
Oh, is that right?
That is correct. Let me tell you how. So the top one is basically is the DM map, and it's basically exactly as Dyson drew it, except that we have transposed numbers onto it. We keyed it.
Yeah.
The bottom map is the player map, which not only have I removed the numbers for, but I've also erased some details. Specifically, it's probably very hard to see on your screen, folks. I apologize for this, but get out your copy of WDM04 if you have it. If you don't, by the way, right now this month, there's a special offer going on. If you join the Patreon this month, you get free access to all of our past dungeon design dashes. They're all available right now.
What?
Only for this month.
That's crazy. Who the hell decided Paul?
I don't know. For those, I was going to save this for the end of the show, but I guess we're getting close to it. For those who don't know, next weekend, Dan and I will be running our sixth Dungeon Design Dash live at the Rising Phoenix Game Con in Milford, Massachusetts. If you're coming to the con, please come. It's on Friday from 3 to 5 p.m., but also we'll be live streaming it. So if you can't get to the con, come and watch and check it out right here on this channel, and you'll see us live create one of our Dungeon Design Dashes at special extra show for you on Friday, this coming Friday at 3 p.m.
Again, it's Eastern time, 3 o'clock Eastern time. Tune in, and we'll be live streaming at a seminar at RPG Con with the people in the room, hopefully assisting us with some ideas, and we'll see whether we can pull it off live in person that time.
Yeah. So to get back to this one, Pumpkin King, the Creeping Doom of the Pumpkin King. So the interesting thing is the player map came out of Dan and I actually running this, right? So we had a friend who wanted us to run an adventure for him. And so we ran this adventure. And I think as a part of that, we decided, oh, wouldn't it be fun if we gave them an actual map? And what map should we give them? And so I was like, well, I'm going to have to at least remove the numbers. And as I was removing the numbers, I thought, you know what? That cave at number 7 is kind of unknown. How about I just erase it? So if you can zoom in, or if you have your copy of WDM04, you'll note that cave in the bottom right corner has been erased from the player's map. Just to not clue them in that it exists, right? It should be a surprise.
Which I think is a great option. So similar to Quagmire a little bit. You've got to get into this area. You've got to do some amount of exploring to get some kind of clues that tell you that there's a thing down there. You can't just go on the map and immediately go to the terminal point. So it's funny that we came up with that later when we were prepping to actually run it. And I think that was a really good idea.
Yeah. And we did modify the PDF that got published. So the PDF that's published does include a full page printable version of the player map for you to hand out to your players, because that is absolutely the way that I recommend running it. Now, the funny thing that I did not remove from the player's map is the weird giant pumpkin kind of towards the upper left. Which of course is how the whole thing got themed. And frankly, I think, Dan, if I remember in this episode, was kind of a surprise to you and I. Like, I don't think we quite noticed the giant pumpkin until we were kind of stalking the map. There's a giant pumpkin?
Right.
Is that a literal giant pumpkin? Right. What's going on there? Right. Yeah.
Yes. We found it halfway in. Now, I will point out, just as a side point, Paul, if I recall, our plan for next Friday at RPG Con when we do it, you asked me a little while ago, should Paul show Dan the map we're going to use in advance? And I think I said no. So I will once again be seeing the map for the first time as we get started, and I will be either surprised or befuddled, and we'll see what comes of that. So I think that's an important part of what we do with the design dash is like see what our first instinct is by surprise.
Yeah, I enjoy that. I enjoy surprising you with the map. Hopefully it's a fun one. It's nice to see what direction we go. So anyway, this is, I don't know, what did you think, Dan, of this experience of playing this game where we presented to the players with, here's a map. And it's a detailed map, again, no scale. Right, it's an outdoor map with no scale on it whatsoever. Missing some pieces of information.
Well, we had a great experience playing through it ourselves. I'm glad that I got to co-DM it with you. Was extra fun. I remember a lot of the play was in the court of the Pumpkin King area too, and we had a lot of like really interesting, you know, interactions in the court, you know, possibly dangerous ones that we had a blast with there. And again, I mean, I'm convinced, I mean, we might not entirely agree. I agree that for a wilderness area, it makes even more sense to give that kind of information. I feel like with the dungeons, right, there is this, as usual, there is this constraint of there's a tunnel that goes left and there's a tunnel that goes right. Those are your options. You don't need that you can verbally describe pretty easily. You don't need to map that out in advance. But in the wilderness, you can go in any direction. There's all kinds of different places, environments, territory that you could possibly get lost, sidetracked in. And I think it makes extra... Plus, it makes sense that people would have some kind of sense about what's in the world around them. So I think that both in-game terms and for the play of the thing, it makes extra sense in the wilderness. And I think that's why I'm certainly comfortable with what was happening in Pumpkin King.
Dan, we have like 5 minutes left, so I want to get to this. You and I both have examples in our notes of a case where a DM, or a case where a product, whatever it is, a case where there's a dungeon map, and the dungeon map is 100% visible to all the players right from the get-go. So I'd like to talk about
the far end of the continuum. The far end of the continuum.
Yeah. Right. Does that work? Is that fun? What does that add or remove from play? What are your thoughts? Let's dig in. Let's talk about those examples.
You want to do yours first or mine first?
Yeah, okay. I'll give you mine. I'll give you mine. Yeah, they're not the same. Mine is from the 1991 version of Basic Dungeons & Dragons that came in a big black box that looked like a board game. If anybody's ever seen this one, it's an unusual print of Basic D&D, but I think it's Beckme more or less. Inside is a large poster sized map that you fold out, and it comes with little cardboard figures, right? I think they were trying to ride the line a little bit, make it look a little bit more like a board game to sell to the mass market, right?
Yeah.
So it came with figures. You would put them in here, and it's kind of similar to, say, playing HeroQuest, which you and I have played, right? So for example, If you zoom in on this map, what you'll see is missing is some important pieces of information, like where are the doors? I think those are missing in this map, right? Because you had maybe little cardboard doors that you would stick in.
Door tokens,
it's very similar again to HeroQuest. I don't know. As much as my gut says, like, oh, this is giving too much information. This is board gaming. This is turning the game into a board game. You're not mapping anymore because it's all right there in front of you. I still think it's pretty fun.
That's great. I believe it. I believe it. Yeah.
Paul, I'm wrong. This reminds me. The doors are here. I'm confused.
I'm sorry.
Correct. If you look at the large square kind of in center left, just like if you look at the word dungeon and you look up, there's a big square. That area like actually is five rooms. If you zoom in there, you'll see that. That's actually five rooms, and they've left some detail out. And the point was, in this game, they're trying to teach you how to play Dungeons & Dragons, so they're introducing ideas as they go. And so that's the point where they introduced, you don't have full information of the layout, and we're going to surprise you with it.
You know, I almost pulled up a photo that we have when we met Dave McGarry showing off his original design for the dungeon game back in the 70s. Same thing. A way to teach D&D. Maybe to people that don't have an expert DM available to them. And the whole thing is basically a board game, very similar to this. And I remember that. It's a pretty interesting photo we have with Dave McGarry showing off his hand-drawn map like that. I played a lot of the dungeon game. It's very replayable. Even seeing the whole dungeon, the question is, how do I get into this dangerous location? Do I go this way? Do I go that way? And there's different pros and cons about which way you take. So highly playable, even if you do have the whole dungeon map in front of you. Yeah. And I think the other case that we have is a number of years ago, we went to GaryCon, and you and I got into a big game run by Bill Webb using Swords and Wizardry Time. running in his Rappan Athic that we both played, used it in bits and pieces for his home game. And what he did is he had an enormous, we had 27 people in the room, and he comes in with a big tapestry-sized printout of one of the level, one of the entire levels of Rappan Athic. And so here you can see there were so many people in the room, and he's so far away at this big convention table. So here we're seeing Bill Webb having gotten up on the table, walked over to it, and he's identifying one of the rooms that we're encountering with as he puts down a beer can on the room that we're currently going into to make that evident to everybody. So a great referee, surprising when he got up on the table, walked over. So I was surprised when he put the map out to begin with. I was surprised when we went down into it immediately. And I was surprised when he got up and walked over onto it, which was highly entertaining. And, you know, the play was, you go, then maybe you have some memories about that yourself. To me, the play was, now it's not exploring what the dungeon's like, but again, exploring what's in it, what's in this place. And and we have all basically first level adventurers, and the monsters are horrible. The monster's like an aboleth or a giant or like 50 piercers or something like that. How do you use your resources to get through this place and get on to the next area? And I feel that this particularly makes a lot of sense in hindsight when you've got a ton of players in the room. Like, you have 27 players, and this is a way that the environment is visible to everybody in the room. And, you know, among the advantages, because I haven't even gotten to talk about, you know, what the takeaways really of, you know, like the couple of times where I stumbled in this by accident, where we're like in Caverns of Thracia, we did some adventuring where the players didn't know the layout, and then they get a treasure map, and then all of a sudden, all the players are more invested. They're interacting better. They're strategizing with the space better. Instead of having like one player who's the mapper that says, "I see there's a way north, and we could backtrack to the south," and they're the only person with that information. When there's a public map like this, everybody can participate in the strategizing as a team, and the whole room energy becomes very different, as everybody can see it and everybody can participate in the decision about where to go next and why. And particularly with an enormous number of players, like 27 that night, I think that made a lot of sense. That was a great choice.
Yeah, I enjoyed this game, and it reminds me of the same effect that I get when we're playing Outdoor Spoliation on the Outdoor Survival map. I'm playing a wilderness hex crawl. Again, everyone can see the map. We can have quick conversations about, oh, we could go here, we could go there, right? So we're just immediately zooming into the decision points. And yes, in this case, you know, the amount of secret information is great, is reduced to just the contents of the room, which is still fun. It's still enjoyable. I think I want just a little more obscurity than this, right? I want just a little more. And I think that's why I lean into the idea of, like, I like the maps to be a little inaccurate, right? I like when they're visible to all the players, and I like when all the players can engage in the strategizing of what major decisions are we making. Should we go into the swamp or the desert? Should we go up these tunnels towards the rooms in the north where we think maybe there's treasure, or should we curve around west where clearly we can reach it through the same way, but we have to cross this river, right? Whatever that is. I enjoy all that a lot. But I think I just want some level of inaccuracy or missing information from the map, which in this case, and again, in that case of the basic D&D map, it's just a little too much, just a tiny bit too much, I think.
I hear you. There were a couple secret areas in Rappan Athic that we found that actually weren't on that map. But nonetheless, in general, I totally hear what you're saying, and I think that's a reasonable decision.
Yeah. One of the examples we didn't get to here, Dan, because we're totally out of time, in fact, now going over, was the original birthday game. I love referring to this. The birthday game. The first game that you and I ever live streamed, where I think I was running Dyson's Delve, and I full on was just projecting the map onto the table. Now I was projecting a zoom in, so you only saw a subset of the map. And I said, I'm just going to move this around, And so you're going to lose context as you go through, unless you also draw your own map at a different scale, which you did.
Yeah. But I think I'm so glad you brought that up, Paul, because again, that was really a benefit to everybody seeing it immediately and everybody participating in where to go next. And I thought, thought that was a, you did a lot of work to set that up. And I thought that would, that actually had a great effect for that game.
I'll just share one more image. I know we're so over time, but I'll share one more image. This is level 6 of Dyson's Delve. And you can see the top is the original map from Dyson. And the bottom is the one I was using at the table. And you can see I have indeed removed secret areas, right? So the whole caves to the north, right. And there's actually another room just south of those that are all just missing from what I was showing you on the table.
Yeah. And we were only seeing a small segment being projected at a time. So maybe like a 10 by 10 area or something like that.
But you would see like a room, maybe a room in the exits, or maybe two rooms. If it was very small, you might see, right. But you were seeing chunks of it. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
And you know, it kind of makes sense. You're trying to describe a room, you know, verbally, but players would immediately see the outskirts of it. And it kind of makes sense, frankly.
All right, Dan, final thoughts on whether or not to reveal the map?
You know, I feel like I'm evolving, Paul, as a referee into giving more information rather than less. And I relearned this lesson over and over again. You hear it in improv classes, too, is at the outset, set the location. Set the location at the outset, and then your viewers or your audience, your players, can interact with it or understand it better. So I've been finding, like we said, that the play group, they interact better, they strategize better, they're a better team when you get maybe some subcomponent map out. If you've never done this, I might recommend an experiment of like just make a single dungeon level and make a treasure map to half of it. Make a treasure map, just give your players a map to half of it. And see how the play changes between the half that they can see in advance and the half they cannot see in advance. Test that out. Find out how that feels to you. And that might give you some extra data about how much information to reveal to your players early up. Because it totally changes the texture of the game many times for the better. And I'm giving more information rather than less to my players over time.
Yeah. Yeah, I definitely enjoy giving the players more information. Again, I want it to be complete or inaccurate in some way. I think that makes it super fun. I love the idea of having the map out in front of everyone so the whole group can pore over it and make strategic high-level decisions as a group. I think that's super fun. But also, I'm now tickled by the idea of creating a map that is purely a text description, a transcript of a verbal description of a location to a treasure. I think that would be really interesting. So I'm very inclined to go play with that at some point.
It might be easier to design. Like if you have a dungeon map already, instead of like having to do graphical editing, which is a little bit intricate, like just writing out text, like go here. Like you're as a DM, you're looking at the map. It might be easier to design. So try that out and see how that works too. Maybe in Dwarven.
Like, I think that's also fun, right? If only half the group, like, I don't think I've been able to play with that in any way. Of like, half the group is allowed to look at the map and the other half is not. That's fascinating.
I will point out that if you have a player, if you have a player that knows, that actually knows a real world language that nobody else does, you can give it to them. You can use Google Translate or something, give it to them in that one language. And maybe if you have one player who knows French, give the handout in French, and then only that player can actually read it. Do we trust them? I don't know.
Yep. viewers, if you have experience with this, you have opinions on whether or not to show the players the map, other examples of adventures where you're encouraged to give players part or all of the map up front, please share it with us. Leave us a comment here in the YouTube video comment section. We'd love to hear from you, and maybe that will set a new topic for us down the road.
Definitely. And of course, remember that you can like, follow, and subscribe to us. We're on YouTube and Twitch and Facebook and TikTok and Loops and GitHub. And we do have the handle Wandering DMs on all of those sites. So please look for us there and expose that like button.
Viewers, if you prefer to listen to our show, an audio-only podcast, and try to imagine the maps that we're describing through only the sound of our voices, you can do so. Those audio files are available on our website at wanderingdms.com. We're also available on various third-party podcast carriers such as iTunes and Spotify and Pocket Cast. If you're listening to us right now on one of those sites and it gives the ability to do so, please rate and review our show. That helps other users of that site find us, and we really appreciate it.
We really do. And of course, huge thanks to our patrons who support the show here. If you'd like to join them, please visit patreon.com/wanderingdms. And like Paul said, every tier gets you access to our private Discord server where the conversation is continuing 24/7 with we just have the best, smartest patrons. So you should go there and see what they have to say about stuff. And it's always illuminating and informative. In addition, it gets you access to our live after chat that will be there a little bit delayed there, about 10 minutes because we've had so much to say here in this show. So we'll be on our live after chat video for extra comments or insights that we didn't get to in the hour here. We would love to see them. Now, a little reminder again, next weekend, we're going to be wandering off to Rising Phoenix Game Con in Massachusetts. Just like Paul said, this Friday, 3 p.m. Eastern time, we'll have a live stream as we do one of our dungeon design dashes live from a seminar at RPGCon. And then we have sessions where we will be playtesting the currently unknown dungeon design product over the course of the weekend. One of those sessions that Paul is running is actually next Sunday at this time. So next Sunday, we won't be live, but we will be playing. We saw a photo of the time that we've played with a wild man, Bill Webb. And so next Sunday, we will be treating you to an interview with Mr. Bill Webb, talking about the current Kickstarter that he has up for Necromancer Games' new role-playing system called The Necromancer's Game. So we had a great chat with Bill Webb. Find out what he's doing with Necromancer Games at the current time. So we hope you'll tune in next week at 1 p.m. Eastern time to see our interview with Bill Webb. Surprise, everybody! We've got an interview with Bill Webb!
No one saw that one coming, Dan. No one had any idea that was going to happen.
I'm so glad! I'm sorry, I like surprising players, or sometimes giving more information, Paul, is interesting too.
Sometimes.
So look for us there in the next week, and we are live almost every Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern time, so we hope you'll join us next week, as well as Friday at 3, for another thought-provoking discussion.
We'll see you then.